I talked to FCC Chairman Ajit Pai about the end of net neutrality. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Molly Wood. This week, the Federal Communications Commission will almost certainly vote to overturn the set of rules commonly known as net neutrality. Instead of preventing internet service providers like Verizon or Comcast from favoring or discriminating against any content on their networks, the FCC says companies should be able to do what they like as long as they are transparent about it. This is controversial. Among other things, the public comment system on the FCC's proposed rules was overtaken by spam and fake accounts. Democrats, consumer groups, and even a few Republicans have called for the vote to be postponed. Republican FCC Chairman Ajit Pai is leading the charge to overturn the rules. I spoke to him from his Washington office, and I asked him, with all this controversy, will the vote go forward?
This vote will happen on December 14th, and the commissioners will be asked to register their views on the proposed order that I put on the table.
In every policy change, there are winners and losers. The expectation is that this will pass, your order will pass. Who are the losers? Who are the potential losers here?
Those who have peddled hysteria and misinformation over the last 3 weeks, suggesting, for example, that the internet as we know it is about to end, that democracy is threatened, that free speech and expression are online are at risk. And when folks wake up on December 15th and the internet is the same and we have returned to the free market framework that has governed the internet for most of its existence, hopefully we can return to a more rational discourse about the future of this terrific online platform that has delivered so much digital opportunity to Americans and to people around the world.
But what does this change actually mean for consumers?
I think it means better, faster, cheaper internet access. If you talk to smaller providers in particular, and I've spoken to many of them from Minnesota to Montana over the past week, they have said that these heavy-handed regulations stand in the way of them building a business case for deploying internet infrastructure, especially in rural and low-income urban areas. And so I think for those consumers who want better access to the internet and more competition, these rules promise a brighter future.
You talk about hysteria and misinformation and the concern that the internet is dying. Nevertheless, a majority of people in a fairly broad swath of polls across political lines are in favor of some net neutrality regulation. How do you answer to them?
Well, I think there is a broad consensus in favor of a free and open internet, but I think the problem is that when you have elected officials and others saying that the internet is about to be destroyed, are you in favor of that or not? There's no surprise, I think, that the polls seem to suggest that there is a level of concern. But I think when you step back and look at the situation with somewhat of a dispassionate view, and you recognize that we're simply returning to the light touch framework that we had starting with President Clinton in 1996 and that went through to until 2015, and that serve the entire internet economy, including consumers, very well, then I think folks will come to recognize that that light touch framework is best calibrated to preserve the free and open internet and to promote more infrastructure investment, which at the end of the day produces a great amount of consumer value.
I want to ask you about the opposition. Are they just wrong? I mean, you know, it's hard to believe that we're talking about a lot of smart people, a lot of lawyers, you know, Vint Cerf. Are they just wrong?
Reasonable people fall on both sides of this issue. There are some folks like the ones you mentioned. There are others like Mark Andreessen and Ben Thompson and Mark Cuban on the other side. At the end of the day, I think if we come to the table and recognize that reasonable people can disagree and that the framework that we had from 1996 till 2015 isn't crazy, then I think it's simply a question of which approach is best calibrated to preserve a free and open internet and infrastructure investment going forward. And based on the evidence in the record, we have found at the FCC, and I'm confident that a court will sustain, as well the public will over time, that the light touch approach that started under President Clinton is ultimately the right one for the American people.
And do you think you've made that argument in a way that people are going to accept? Or do you think that some of this anger and hysteria, as you've described it, is going to keep going after the vote?
Well, look, I know that people are very passionate about all things having to do with the internet, and I would hope that they would focus on the facts and, to the maximum extent possible, ignore some of the hysteria about the internet ending. When they wake up on December 15th and they realize that the internet actually does work and they're able to tweet and email and surf and do all the great things that people are able to do on the internet, they'll recognize that they should put the hysteria aside and focus on the facts. And the facts are that this regulatory framework we are about to adopt is the one that is proven to work for the American people and will continue to benefit them in the exciting times to come.
There has, since 1996, been a lot of consolidation of internet service providers buying content companies. Why do you trust internet service providers to deliver content at fair prices to all people when there is an inherent interest?
Two different points on that. Number one, we don't trust any particular company or sector of the industry to regulate itself. And that is precisely why, under my plan, we require very robust transparency that internet service providers have to disclose the particulars of their business practices and service offerings and the like. That's also why we empower the Federal Trade Commission to take targeted action against any company that engages in anti-competitive conduct or engages in an unfair or deceptive trade practice. Point number one. Point number two, it's also amusing to hear this criticism from those who in the previous administration okayed over $250 billion of consolidation, including among companies that sought to combine network operations and content. And so I think if that was the real concern that they had, they should have spoken up over the previous 8 years.
Well, with all due respect, I think consumers had those concerns all along, but maybe felt then and feel now that those concerns are not being represented. We are talking about, after all, some of the most hated companies in America.
Well, again, here, this is why we require FCC transparency and Federal Trade Commission enforcement. My point is simply that those who okayed a lot of these transactions in the previous administration can't come back and criticize the very predicate that those transactions were founded upon.
In the U.S., you're very familiar with these numbers. We have talked about broadband competition before. 55% of consumers have only one major broadband provider. Most of the remaining 45% have only two. Does transparency help them if there is no option?
Two different points. Number one, this is why I've consistently said that it is competition, not preemptive regulation from the FCC, that will solve the problem that consumers are most concerned about. And that's exactly what the FCC has done under my leadership over the past year, promoting much more fixed wireless competition, satellite competition, and small company competition in terms of wireline and cable infrastructure in rural areas. And these are the ways to incentivize much more competition. Number two, if you look at where some of the smaller companies are that are struggling under these regulations, these internet regulations, they are the ones who say, look, if you relieve us of this regulatory burden, we are going to invest in rural America and other parts of the country where there isn't sufficient competition.
So your order doesn't just remove Title II classification and the open internet order. It also rolls back bans as far back as 2005 on throttling and blocking certain types of content. Is there evidence that those rules were harming innovation?
There is no such ban. The ban that we were talking about, all these regulations dated to 2015. I know some have peddled the misinformation again that these regulations are older than that, but there were no such rules prior to 2015. And secondly, what we want to do is empower the Federal Trade Commission once again to be an effective cop on the beat for competition and for consumer protection. And prior to 2015, the FTC itself had instituted a number of different actions against internet service providers, including on the issue of throttling. They took action against AT&T, for example, another wireless company called TracFone. And so I think the FTC is a very effective cop on the beat if the FCC allows it to be.
Even if the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is enforcing the law, won't that happen after the fact, after some violations have already occurred or consumers have already been harmed?
Here I would commend to your listeners' attention a blog post by a Silicon Valley entrepreneur named Ben Thompson, who writes a blog called Stratechery. And he said, and I quote, why Ajit Pai is right. And he explained that the question was about before the fact regulation at the FCC versus after the fact regulation at the FTC. And his argument was that the more careful, targeted scalpel, so to speak, of FTC enforcement is appropriate. That is the best way to ensure that any competitive conduct is deterred and to make sure that companies have the strongest possible incentive to deploy infrastructure. And as he put it, the preemptive regulation that the FCC might seem appealing, but it has very serious unintended consequences. When you preemptively declare every single company in the United States a monopolist and regulate them like a slow-moving utility, unsurprisingly, a slow-moving utility and an oligopoly in some markets is what you're going to get. And so I think that FTC enforcement is a much better way, the scalpel of the FTC, as opposed to the sledgehammer at the FCC.
So, but even if some regulations go away to make it easier for new competition to enter the broadband market, starting an ISP is still breathtakingly expensive and difficult. How long might it be before consumers benefit from increased competition?
Well, two different points. I think these heavy-handed regulations make that business case even more difficult, and so it takes us in the opposite direction of getting more competition. Secondly, if you look at a lot of the initiatives we've engaged in over the past year in terms of directing federal subsidies to unserved areas, to modernizing our rules to get consumers from copper to fiber, those are initiatives that are actively underway, and I would say in the coming years we are going to see massive investments in infrastructure, not just as a result of this of these internet regulations being removed, but because of those initiatives. And over time, consumers will see the bang for the buck when it comes to broadband deployment.
What are the regulations? What is the biggest thing holding back ISPs right now?
I think the biggest thing is simply the regulatory barriers that stand in the way of broadband deployment. For example, if you want to lay fiber over a federal highway out in the West, first of all, you have to get approval from the requisite federal agency that might have title to the land. There might be state and local regulations that stand in your way. If you want access to the utility poles to string that fiber, you might have to get an agreement from the utility on reasonable rates and time for the attachment. And so all of these different steps, and that's just for fiber companies, for wireless companies, there are other barriers that stand in the way. Satellite companies have to also negotiate rights to the spectrum that is used. So I think it's very difficult in a lot of cases to get some of these regulatory barriers streamlined such that we can preserve the public interest, but also give these companies a chance to promote more access in parts of the country that often are find themselves on the wrong side of the digital divide. And at the FCC, a lot of the work that we have done, I would say the lion's share of the work this year, has been focused on closing that divide by modernizing our rules.
One other argument that critics have raised is that investment, at least by big ISPs, is up. Comcast spent $7.6 billion on capital expenditures in cable during 2016. That's the most they've ever invested in a single year. Census data seems to show that investments during 2015 by telecoms were up more than $500 million from 2014. Where's the disconnect there?
If you look at our order, and for the first time, I have directed that these orders be made public so the American people can read it for themselves, you will see detailed analysis about how infrastructure investment is lower than it would have been because of these regulations. We point to the 5.6% decline in overall infrastructure investment, and we also observe that those studies purporting to show that there's been an increase actually count things like AT&T's investment of billions of dollars in Mexico to upgrade its wireless networks. They also account for accounting changes by companies like Sprint moving handsets from capital operating expenses to capital expenses. That has none of those activities has anything to do with building an actual network in the United States. When you actually look at apples to apples comparisons, you find that infrastructure investment is lower. And that's part of the reason why I have argued that what consumers are most concerned about, which is getting access in the first place or getting more competition, those preferences are disserved by these heavy-handed regulations. Let's focus on where we all agree, which is on the need for more infrastructure investment, and leave the sort of 1930s paradigm of utility-style regulation behind.
And what if, you know, some of these nightmare scenarios, let's just game plan some things in the short term, in the next year, say. What if Comcast, you know, starts offering packages that include free streaming of NBC Universal programs, but they charge double or triple to add YouTube or Netflix?
And there again, the Federal Trade Commission is directly empowered to take action against any conduct that is either anti-competitive under the competition laws or that it finds is an unfair or deceptive trade practice under Section 5 of the FTC Act. And they have a long history of doing this. They've instituted over 500 enforcement actions in history against some of these companies for certain practices they found to be hurting consumers and or competition. And that's exactly what they would do going forward.
And then I have to ask you about the comment period, this period of public comment where people have been able to weigh in on the rules. Many of those comments seem to have come from bots. What procedure do you have to evaluate the millions of comments you've received? And does this comment period matter?
It does matter. We received more commentary on this proceeding than anyone that we've ever had in the past. And we have erred on the side of open participation. We want as many Americans to participate as possible. And if you look at the order again, every single proposition we make is footnoted. We include citations to the comments that we relied upon. And we sussed out in the record all of the comments that were touching on some of the issues that we raised back in May when we kicked off this proceeding. And so I'm confident that at the end of the day, when a court looks at this or when the public looks at it, they will recognize that we relied on facts that are in the record and that are well substantiated and not on some of the other commentary that you referenced.
So you're saying you feel like you were able to differentiate from the fake comments from the real comments?
Absolutely. We do not rely, for example, on the 400,000 comments that purported to be from Russia and were in support of these internet regulations. We focus on the comments in the record that meaningfully grappled with some of the proposals that we teed up this past spring.
Chairman Pai, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now, back in June on our Make Me Smart podcast, Kai Rizdal and I spoke to Terrell McSweeney, a Democratic member of the Federal Trade Commission, about whether the FTC could police the internet.
The open internet rules also protect non-economic values like speech, right, and access to content. Those are issues that we as an agency don't historically focus on. We focus on competition markets. So in certain areas, we may not even have sufficient authority under antitrust law and doctrine to go after some of the conduct that we're talking about.
That was a remarkably prescient conversation. You can hear the whole thing if you subscribe to that podcast, too. Now, of course, there have been net neutrality protests both online and off. Those are expected to continue up until tomorrow's vote. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM. Thanks for listening to Marketplace Tech. Here is an investment opportunity for you with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at the Candida Fund. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You also help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism you can trust. So don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Give today at marketplace.org, and thank you.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.